You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KGEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sange, your host for The Weekend. And joining us today is my guest host, Dennis Wu, also one of my colleagues here at KGEP, no stranger, of course, to our listening audience as he hosts Morning Jazz, and he anchors the Texas Standard from here in El Paso. And today we're very honored to be with a former colleague of ours, journalist Carlos Rosales, who's been all over. As far as journalist goes, he's been a print journalist, he's been a photojournalist, he's been a broadcast journalist. So he's here to talk a little bit about how we look back at 2016 and also how the news have changed over the years. Dennis?
Welcome, Carlos.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm honored. Thank you.
We're honored to have you here. You're quite a celebrated journalist, although rather undercover in this part of the country, which is pretty cool. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is the notion of people in El Paso thinking that Juarez is safe to go to and visit and everything, and yet we've seen an escalation in the murder rate in Ciudad Juarez. What's going on?
Well, it is not at any level close to the worst time, which was 2010, when more than 3,000 people lost their lives throughout Juarez and the Valle de Juarez. Right now, last year, 2015, ended with 300 homicides, which was the lowest. And we started seeing a slight increase around the spring and summer, with the highest number of homicides being in October, where at least 103 people were killed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the notion is that it's an isolated set of circumstances in Ciudad Juarez, mostly in Juarez, and maybe stretching out a little bit in the northern part of Chihuahua. But now, as we tape this show, and as we talked about earlier this morning, a murder in Albuquerque seems to either be mocking the beheadings of snitches, so to speak, or those who turn their backs on the cartels. They've discovered another body up in the northwestern part, I think. It's the northwestern part of Albuquerque. And it seems to follow the same kind of modus operandi.
Well, that body turned out to be was beheaded. The person, the victim, was beheaded, which has a lot of obvious similarities to, you know, murders in Mexico that are tied to the cartels. If it's up there, chances are, if it is tied into the drug trade, they wanted to send a message. A very visual message to people, you know, don't steal from us. If you owe us money, pay us back or else. And obviously, you know, this person got the worst of it. It happens a lot. We're seeing the violence once again escalate. But now we don't have the old cartels. We have the new ones, cartels like the Cartel de Jalisco Nueva Generación, CJNG, and they're very violent. They are making the Gulf and Zeta cartels look like peaceful people in comparison. And they're made of young kids who grew up well off thanks to their family's involvement in the drug trade, and they've just kind of taken over. And they don't seem to respect, if you will, human life, as it will. Not that a lot of the cartels do, but we're seeing that in the Cartel de Jalisco and also now with El Chapo, you know, in prison. We're getting several groups within the Sinaloa cartel that are fighting for control. Everybody from Mayo Zambada to the Beltran Leyvas, they're all, you know, familial to El Chapo in one way or another. Plus, you have El Chapo's five sons who also have some hand in the drug trade, plus El Chapo's younger brother who also is in there. So you've got at least 3 to 5 groups within the Sinaloa cartel that are fighting for control. And then you still have, of course, the Gulf and the Zetas, although maybe not in a big part. The Tijuana cartel is also still out and about. The Beltran Leyvas, of course, are fighting with the Tijuana cartel. You're seeing a lot of violence in Tijuana. So yeah. it's still an open game.
Carlos, tell us a little bit about, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, you were a photojournalist for many years, and that's how I met you when you were working for the newspaper. And tell us the stories about some of the – well, you brought in some pictures, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us some of those stories, and also telling us about some of the pictures that you remember taking so many years ago but still, you know, stick in your mind.
Well, one of the things that I've been very fortunate in, I have had wonderful teachers like you when you were reporting on TV. I remember watching you and learning from you when I would be out there taking still pictures. I'd watch you reporting. Dennis has taught me so much about audio. He's the best audio guy in the Southwest as far as I'm concerned. And I had a lot of good teachers. Some went on to win Pulitzers and work in the big papers, and I just learned from them, and I was very fortunate. One of the stories here, a lot of people don't remember that the space shuttle Columbia actually landed in White Sands years ago. I remember camping out there for days in these trailers and getting all our equipment sandblasted because of the gypsum sand that was blowing, because they had to postpone the landing one day. And, you know, the same shuttle decades later, I covered when it blew up over Texas, unfortunately. Had to cover that. At that point, I was already in broadcast journalism, and I was working at KOAT in Albuquerque. And I remember the radar showing that it was going to fly over Albuquerque on its landing path to Florida, go through Texas. And unfortunately, you know, it exploded. I remember seeing a little white speck on my telephoto lens on my camera, and 10 minutes later we hear it blew up. I also covered the Challenger disaster. That was my first shuttle disaster, if you will. And I remember working at the Houston Post as a photojournalist, and we were in the newsroom watching the launch when suddenly, boom, you know, it exploded, and 45 minutes later, three teams of reporters and photographers, myself included, were in a Learjet on the way to Florida to cover the whole thing. And I remember sitting on the docks near Cape Canaveral waiting for the Coast Guard and Navy ships to come in with debris they'd collected and, God forbid, you know, human remains. We couldn't see obviously the human remains or clear views of the debris, but we could see large drums on the decks of the ships as they came in, you know. So that was something. I remember covering President Reagan at the memorial he held at the Johnson Space Center with all the teachers, because I remember one of the astronauts was a teacher.
Krista McAuliffe.
Yes, Krista McAuliffe. And, you know, it just was very moving.
We were discussing, well, not that long ago, and November, about the assassination of President Kennedy and how so many photographers were kind of like, oh my gosh, if I had film in my camera at that time, or if I had shot this. And people wondered about, and if I'm sharing this because you've been with us and you've seen so many of the evolution of photojournalism and how it's taken off. The assassination of President Kennedy actually escalated TV news. Because people suddenly wanted to watch everything. But isn't it amazing to you that of a presidential visit, all those cameras, reporters were covered, only one amateur photographer?
He happened to be shooting
Zapruder.
Mm-hmm. Zapruder, and he shot 8mm film. And recently his daughter donated the film to, I'm not 100% sure, the
Well, his granddaughter wrote a book called
Right.
26 Seconds.
And it's amazing. You know, you listen, here's a guy who just took a break and went to shoot the president coming by. And when I worked in Dallas, I used to drive by there every day. And all I could remember was Zapruder's film, even though I'm looking at the street and the book depository and everything. But what would come to mind is the film.
And as far as what you saw back then and what we see on TV, now it's like that wouldn't even happen because everybody has access to video and ready to post it.
Well, now, of course, the biggest plus, if you will, for current media are cell phone cameras. I mean, everybody has one, and you know, you can be trying to shoot an event and have to fight your way through 50 cell phone cameras that are up in front of you. So everybody is a photojournalist in one way or another nowadays, and it's a big plus. But personally, I also think it's intruded and impacted the quality of photojournalism.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because one of the things that I've noticed over the years since the smartphone has been developed is that we've dumbed down the audience so that they actually accept bad video, and I think that's really a crime.
Well, as a guy who started in photography, working in labs at age 16, I have to agree 100%. Because one of the things that was drummed into me or I'd get fired is quality, quality, quality. You have to focus. You have to light it. You have to, you know, compose it. Composition is you know, paramount on every shoot you take. One of the problems, something as simple as your cell phone camera, people shoot vertically instead of horizontally. You know, if it's a fire and it's obviously a house, it's horizontal when you're looking at it. But again, they shoot with their cell phone, so it'll be a vertical shot, which crops out a lot of the important items in the shot. And you try to explain it, but, you know, sometimes, hey, at least I've got video of it. And you kind of look the other way and you say, okay, this will do. But in your head, you're thinking, man, if they'd only turn that camera the other way.
Well, yeah, but trying to educate the masses almost nowadays is impossible. Is that simply because they're going to do what they want to do with the camera regardless? The other thing that I see is that they'll zoom into something, and so you get the shake of the hand and the arm. And, you know, even if you try to keep it steady, because you've zoomed in so far, the heartbeat starts to make that video pulse, and it makes it very unwatchable. And yet the audience says, oh, God, that's great video, and that just sucks. I'm sorry.
It is hard to look at stuff sometimes. And, you know, a lot of the new video cameras come with monitors instead of an viewfinder. So a lot of the people, they're not photographers per se. They're producers, reporters, you know, multimedia journalists, as we call them nowadays. We used to call those a one-man band a couple of years ago, you know, and we've all done it. But the problem with that is they will go wide on something and try to interview a person. And you notice that the person is out of focus, but the background, the trees, the cars are perfect. They're sharp, but the person is out of focus. That's another, you know, learning issue.
So what has that done to you, like as a professional? You have something to post, and sometimes these people will post it just to post it to see how many hits they get or shares on YouTube. And unfortunately, they may post it before a relative has been notified or before it has become official. And so that takes it away from you all.
Well, that is a very important item. You know, they grab something and boom, it's on Facebook already minutes later. And then you get the release from the El Paso Police Department that says, we're not releasing the person's name until next of kin are notified. And unfortunately, we had several incidents this past weekend where that we went through that. And we will stop and wait for police to notify the families, because the last thing we want to do is have them learn of a loved one's death by watching our video. It's not worth it. You know, you don't want to bring that kind of grief to anybody anytime.
So what's the biggest story of 2016?
Well, here on the border, Pope Francis, of course. I mean, we worked on that one for months leading into the February 17th, 18th. And it was incredible. You know, the border grew by at least a million, you know, fans, and it was incredible. I'd covered Pope John Paul in San Antonio and in Chihuahua, Monterrey, But I'd never seen such a large crowd, and just the I don't want to say fanaticism, but people were just going crazy, and rightfully so. I mean, when you know, for many, this is the first and last time they'll ever see a pontiff this close.
What about it seems like people look back and go, God, 216, what's wrong with this world? What's going on? You see these shootings. You see the Syrian people trying to emigrate. You see the police killings. You see the police shooting African-American people. And so people are wondering, what is going on? What has our world gone to?
If I knew, I could have run for president, too. Unfortunately, I think a lot of it is just making sure our kids, our young people, perhaps toughen up. Life is not easy, and a lot of times we protect them, but we have to teach them how to protect themselves, whether it's being able to accept reality that there is death and destruction out there, or even physically when you're driving. I mean, you have to take the rope and make sure that the kids know how to deal with stress, with death, awful things, because life is beautiful, but sometimes it's not, and that's what you have to teach them.
We're discussing also about you know, some of the many movie stars and the singers that left us in 2016, and that prompted me to ask you about the movie star that you covered, and well, both of us did, in Juarez, and that's Steve McQueen. And when we realized that a lot of people don't know who Steve McQueen was, we realized just how old we're getting. But then Steve McQueen was only 50 years old when he died.
Well, Steve McQueen was an incredible actor, an action figure, as you would call him nowadays. McQueen, unfortunately, had been dealing with cancer. And he had looked and searched for cures all over the world, and he had heard of a doctor in Juarez who supposedly had a cure, so he came down here. Unfortunately, during the treatment, if you will, he passed away. He died. And I, being from the border and having family in Juarez and El Paso, the head of the medical autopsy and the funeral home that was dealing with his body knew me and knew my grandfather, and I managed to get in on the autopsy, which, trust me, it wasn't pretty, but also knew it was important to document. I'm sure McQueen and his then-girlfriend, Ollie McGraw, hated it. But we got that, and then I was able to hitch a ride in the hearse that was taking his body in a casket back to El Paso so they can put on a jet to fly to Hollywood. And so it was me and Steve in the back of a hearse at the Cordova Bridge, the Bridge of the Americas, just him and me. And that was weird. Now, the older I am now, the more it impacted me. Back then, I was 20-something and honestly, too stupid to really realize how big this was. When I got back to the El Paso Times, I had everybody and their mother wanting pictures and, you know, all these photo agencies and stuff. And we provided the pictures. I mean, it wasn't about me. It wasn't about me taking pictures. It was about this incredible actor dying in our backyard in a hopeless search for a cure for his illness. What's eerie is, you know, the El Paso Times has popped up articles on, you know, every anniversary of his death or every couple of years. And I work at KVIA Channel 7. And I looked at the story in the El Paso Times and I'm, wow, here it is. Nobody in my newsroom, and there were about seven people in it, knew who he was. Now, you talk about feeling old. That was my dinosaur experience. Not the first, and I'm sure won't be the last.
Yeah, I think Louis and I get that quite a lot from a lot of our students, too, because it's just something that happens. History goes so quickly by these kids, and what's relevant to them is only what's relevant in their world. So they don't do what we used to do back in the day, which is to absorb everything so that we could have a little bit of knowledge on everything, which is one of the things I learned from you when you trained me to become a news producer way back when. It's an amazing thing. I'm sitting in this room with gentlemen who have been not only friends but mentors over the years, and you've taught me so much about photography and so much about journalism. Louis taught me so much about journalism and how to frame a story. I mean, it's an incredible thing, and when we try to give it back to our students, I think sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle because they don't understand the magnitude of the passion that we went into this business with.
One of the things you're seeing, and this is what I've asked students before when I've been invited to talk, like at Louis Sign's class and at NMSU with Bruce Berman, an incredible photojournalism instructor, his classes, I always ask them, who wants to be a journalist? Who wants to be a star? And I get all these hands up when I ask them who wants to be a star. And I promptly tell them, all you stars, get out of the classroom right now. Because my mindset, and I'm sure the younger people will accuse me of being a dinosaur, is if you're a good journalist, the stardom follows. You will be recognized at McDonald's. People at Denny's will offer you an extra strip of bacon, you know, because you're a celebrity. But that comes if you're good. Don't try to be the star at the beginning. And I see that with a lot of the younger generation. And you have to have a hunger or a yearning to be a journalist, to be a storyteller. Let's just call it what it is. Journalists, broadcast journalists, are storytellers. And they tell stories to people on TV.
So tell us about some of the other stories that go behind these pictures. You had a very interesting picture there where you said somebody had been run over on the border highway?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Years ago, before the border fence, before they built all these fences, downtown El Paso used to have a pretty large transvestite population. They used to walk around selling their services to middle-class married men who drove down from wherever to have a fling, if you will. And they would the transvestites would come across late afternoon or at night. They'd pay a rubber raft guy a buck to, you know, swim them across so they wouldn't get wet. They'd climb the bank. And before that, they'd take pills that made their, to help them deal with the stress and, you know, just the horrific things they had to do to earn a buck. And that would impact their depth perception of these pills. So here they are trying to run across the border highway, and, you know, they've taken these pills, and they can't tell that that car is closer than it appears, and they'd get hit, and I must have covered 3 to 5 pedestrian fatalities there. And you'd hear it on the police radio going, female pedestrian hit, and then you'd get there and go, you know, the officer, the investigator's going hemming and hawing because it's not a woman. It's a guy dressed as a woman. Anyway, that was one of the many stories.
And the Phelps Dodge?
Oh, that was I covered the Phelps Dodge strikes way back then. And I remember the police.
In Arizona?
No, this is here in El Paso. Okay. This is off of Trowbridge.
Okay, those.
And Delta. And I covered it, and they started swinging baseball bats, and the police started swinging batons. And we had one heck of a party. I was on the front row there. Taking pictures of the people getting hit and arrested and the officers getting hit and trying to arrest people for unlawful, you know, congregation and acts and so forth.
You talked a little bit about what we used to call, as you said, one-man band. And it seems like it's going back to the one-man band because I guess they don't want to pay to have the extra people going up there. Newsrooms are getting smaller, and so they're having one person do what 2 or 3 people used to do. How is that affecting our coverage?
Well, it gives more credibility to one person simply because they can do all these things. The equipment is a lot better. suited now. When us guys here were one-man bands, the cameras weighed 40 pounds and the sticks weighed another 50 pounds. Nowadays, with the newer, you know, high-definition, smaller cameras, you can carry everything with you, including a laptop, and edit your video, your shots in the field, and then FTP them or, you know, send them via cell phone back to the station, which is something we didn't have the luxury of doing. And I'm still old. I carry an old dinosaur camera with a DVC tape in it, and I'm out there shooting at all hours. And I still love the thrill of driving fast to make my deadline. I know it's an old thing, but whereas most of the kids now, they'll just stick it in the computer, edit it there, and FTP it or cell phone it back to the station.
But there's something about meeting a deadline, correct?
Oh, it still is, yeah. Even if you get there and you have everything ready 5 minutes before air, it's like, yeah, I did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I've noted, because you and I went and did the Anthony Scalia body return to El Paso at 1:30 in the morning. And I remember having that feeling of, man, if we make this deadline, we're good. Because everybody was fighting for the shot. And not. They didn't understand what the whole magnitude of this wait for the body to show up was really all about.
Yeah, it was 3 in the morning and the funeral home in Northeast. And I remember we're waiting and we weren't sure exactly what was. We knew they were driving in from East Texas, you know, further out. And they were going to come in, but we didn't know how, and we waited there. And suddenly we see some DPS squad cars, you know, and a van. So at that point, you get ready to jump, and we did.
It's a fun time. We need to ride again and do that again. You know, one of the things, Louis, that Carlos and I share is this whole notion of being able to beat the competition at their own game. I think that's one of the best things that I could tell you. When you're a journalist, that's what you want to do, is you want to be the best. Carlos is definitely the best, and he's, my opinion, underappreciated by the folks he works with at the station. I'm just saying that because I can.
Well, I appreciate that, Dennis, and I appreciate you guys teaching me a lot. Not that you're older than me. I'm just the young buck, yeah. But I'm still out there, and everybody's got to remember – You keep learning. You don't stop learning. Right. I mean, any given day, I'm learning from your interns, from your staff who are younger. They're in their 20s. And I'm learning from the kids out, you know, in my newsroom. And
that's
ideally,
right.
You'd never stop learning.
The day we stop learning is the day we stop doing whatever we're doing. Thank you, Carlos.
Well, thank you very much.
We've been visiting with veteran news journalist Carlos Rosales, also my colleague and co-worker, Dennis Wu. I'm Louis Sines. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Sines.